This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
And Hildy was especially able in presenting ceremonial tea for us. And discussing what tea is about or why it is the way it is. and our friend newly identified as Kayam. His name has been changed, but now he's Kayam. Kane gave us very intense and personal experience of our own bodies, appreciating the basic energy within ourselves from his experience in yoga and Taoist traditions. So we'll just, this morning we'll reflect something of the directions in which we were going during this retreat. So I'll ask which one of you would like to speak.
Sure. So in the exploration of the weekend, what we did to begin was we traveled back somewhat mythologically to what we imagine and what we sort of know from what historians and translators are tracking back, kind of the origins of Zen back to Chan, and then imagining the time when Buddhism arrived in China, and to try to tune into the worldview and the embodied experience of the people of that time, and how a teaching and a way of thinking from India might have been received. And so to play with that, I'll ask us all to think about things that we have learned that have come from other cultures and how we received those things with our current cultural understanding and within our current worldview. And then we began to allow those new ideas to work within what we already thought we understood about the world, and a kind of new understanding emerges from the interaction, from the relationship. So in playing with this, we travel all the way back to what we could call the shared spiritual vision of every place on the planet. And we could call that animistic or animism. And this word essentially means that ancient people saw every living thing as a unique expression of the existence tissue. And the idea of an inanimate object didn't exist. A boulder was as alive as a butterfly. A river was a being that isn't just looked at, but it's looking back at us. A falling leaf is as alive and as expressive as an elephant. And this view would have just been assumed to be true, it would be ubiquitous, so it wouldn't need to be talked about. Kind of the same way a fish doesn't need to talk with an octopus about the nature of water. It's simply the medium within which the experience of suchness is happening for all of the beings and things. And so for us to play around with traveling back, the invitation, at least for the talk and perhaps, you know, for the rest of the day, is to put on the lens, to look through the view teaching of the animistic vision, and to relate to all beings and things as expressions of this aliveness, right? In ancient India, that would be called prana, right? In China, qi. In Japan, ki. In Hawaii, mana, right? And the idea was that beings and things don't actually exist as fundamentally separate. We name them so we can relate to them according to their nature, but it's more like each one is a strand, a thread, and an unbroken weave, and they don't, in their own nature, they don't have separate beingness, nameness. And so what happens when we live our life in that kind of relationship? And so if we enter from that place, one way of interpreting Dharma is simply the relatedness with all beings, things, as a living expression of that one suchness that we could call Tao. Right? And so in that ancient time, probably the word Tao and Taoism weren't really being used because, again, this was just an understanding that was implicit in the way of seeing. Right? And the ism part sort of came later. But as Buddhism is arriving with its understanding of Dharma, its understanding of mind, its understanding of causal links, it was received into this world. And so to play around a little bit more, let's play around with some of the language that comes from that ancient time and showed up in the reading today in the Xinjing Ming, the word Tao and the word De. So the classic text of Taoism, right? Tao De Ching. So Tao and De, we can understand those as Tao nature itself, not excluding anything. De, self nature of any one of the 10,000 things. And so Tao De is a kind of composite of not to, right? But to be able to enter into relatedness, in other words, perhaps to practice Dharma for the joy of being in relationship, for the joy of expressing that which is the only truth, not to, we gave some kind of names to things, right? So if they're all just Tao, I can't say good morning, right? And I can't say, wow, I love the color of your hair and the color of your eyes. And so Tao Da. So self nature, there's that boulder expressing the suchness of how it is right now. And if we look at it, we realize, oh, it along with everything else is changing, 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 becoming something else, becoming sand. Right? The lichen is eating that boulder and it's changing, 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 becoming something else. And so this kind of a cosmology of playfulness is really at the heart of the animistic roots. It's there in Taoism and it's there in the playful vision of almost every spiritual tradition. If we trace it far enough back, it's connected to the land. It's connected to the fundamental idea that relationship itself is sacred. And we could even take a step further back and say relatedness itself is the sacred. Relatedness itself is the sacred. And so when words like qi get translated to English, we say, oh, qi means energy. But that word functions in the worldview of like post-colonial, you know, scientific post-colonial mindset. But it's not really what it means in the context of an animistic culture. Qi means the place where things are related. It means relatedness. Relatedness itself is the life tissue expressing itself. And so what if Dharma is to play on the infinite number of contact points where relatedness is expressing the suchness of not to, the suchness of the already and always perfect as it is truth? And what if we can play with that, with everything that we do? And so the ancient animists and the ancient Taoists said, well, there's two basic ways that those tend to show up. And they call these two basic ways yin and yang. right? And they said they're always in relationship with each other, like all things. So they show up as sun and moon, as night and day, not two. They show up as birthing and dying, not two. Right? They show up as waking up and falling asleep, not two. And so they said, okay, well, there's stillness and movement, not two. So let's practice those things. Let's not just mindlessly do moving or mindlessly do non-moving. Let's practice those as embodiments of that sacred. And so we're going back before the idea of meditation, right? It's not a thing yet. It's just to notice that, oh, for human beings, sometimes we're like boulders. We don't seem to move at all. We have this kind of stillness. And sometimes we move around like the insects or like the monkeys. We move and do all kinds of things. What if in both the stillest aspect of our expression, the most yin and the most active, fast, kind of intense movement we make, what if we never depart from that wholeness that Taoists would have called intrinsic nature equal to Tao, and Buddhists call innate Buddha nature? And what if we practice in that way? And then out of that, this basic idea of yin and yang and light and dark and day and night, they notice that there's four basic patterns and one pattern that holds them all, that human beings seem to be in relationship with all the time. And these four patterns became what we now call the five elements, wuxing, right? Elements isn't a good word in English. For an English-speaking person, an element is something on the periodic table that you learn about in chemistry class. In the context of the animistic vision, phase, tendency to behave, might be a better way of thinking about it, a dynamic process. And so one invitation was to notice that throughout the year, in the springtime, so we just passed spring equinox, the whole chi of the situation is that the earth is softening and sprouting things are coming up out of it and they're going straight up. Everything is growing and the chi of the situation is going up with new things. And it creates a kind of coherence inside our human system. We see flowers, we see grasses, and there's something in us that goes, wow. And we know with our body, we know that there's a growing of the light. The days are getting longer. And so they called that wood or rising up chi. And they said, oh, we can practice in relatedness with that quality, harmonizing with that quality, and finding what now in modern times we would call secure attachment. We could translate that idea that I'm in resonance with this quality of the seasonal pattern because nature is body and body is nature. And then they followed that around the whole year. So they said that spring quality, wood, gives rise to another quality, which is expanding. It gets hot on summer solstice. Fire, radiance, everything's open and big, and there's a certain mood, a certain feeling, that chi is radiant. And then that curves around, and then in the autumnal time, the trees just let go of their leaves, and the leaves fall without trying to fall. And so there's a descending quality. The days are getting shorter, the light is getting less, the heat is getting less. But they call that metal. Not metal like an element, but metal like cutting away, like falling down, letting go. And then, of course, all the way around the circle, at the winter solstice, there's a sense of everything kind of going deep within itself, becoming still and quiet. And there's a kind of mood to that quality of the winter solstice, very internal and still and nourished within itself. And then, of course, after that solstice happens, then the days start getting longer again. And in the middle of all of that is what has been translated as earth. Sort of like the still point that we're experiencing from all of these movements. And so they said, hey, well, we can play within this realm, yin and yang, sun and moon, waking and sleeping, movement and stillness, rising, expanding, descending, condensing, and the still point. And that became really the cosmology through which people saw the whole process of being alive. Right? So a cosmology of everything is alive and animated, and I'm in relationship with it. It expresses constant change of yin and yang. It expresses a constant change of movement through the five phases of the year. And then it expresses a kind of swelling and disappearing that the lunar cycle. And basically that was the timekeeper and the sense of envelopment for the human being to feel securely attached, in other words, at home in the nature of being human. And then family, and then, you know, religion, and then politics, and all of those things happened. But the larger life tissue was these natural patterns. And so Buddhism arrives into that. And then what unfolds becomes the revolutionary practice and mindset of Chan Zen. And then it travels to Japan and to America and to everywhere else. But it brings with us this legacy, which is, you could say, it's very feminine in a way. It's body positive. It's earth positive. It recognizes the seasonal patterns and the total life tissue as absolutely essential ground for us to even just come and spend one moment sitting zazen. So there's a chapter from the Tao Te Ching that we selected. I thought it was relevant for this talk. Hildy's gonna read that.
So this is chapter 52 for anybody who wants to look it up later. There is a mother that gestates all under heaven. To experience the mother is to observe her children. Embrace the children and you return to the mother. This is called going beyond birth and death. I close the channels and shut the gates. My chi is collected. I open the channels to interact. My chi flows outward. In either case, to see the subtle is clarity. To be gentle is true strength. The union of clarity and true strength is natural light. This is called practicing the always so.
Any native Chinese speakers? Can you pronounce the word Ziron for us? Do you know this word? Self, so, suchness?
Ziran.
Ziran.
Yeah.
Yeah. How does that word land on you? Like, what does it mean when you hear it?
It reminds me of the forest.
Bingo. So that's the lens into exactly what we're talking about. The word in English gets translated as so of itself, suchness, thusness, which are beautiful in a certain way. But when that word lands in your heart mind, all of a sudden nature. This is how Buddhism arrived from India into a land where everybody went, oh yeah, that's just like, you know, kind of like we do when we hear about new ideas. Oh yeah, yeah, I understand that. That's like what we call forest spirit. We have trees over here that are our ancestors. Right. And that's what the native people of the Americas did when philosophical ideas came from Europe. They went like, oh yeah, this valley, that's my grandmother. And Europeans went, what are you talking about? That's not how we view the world. But people everywhere viewed the forest and the boulders and the rivers And the mountains as literally as their ancestors, as their own body. And this view, as far as our teacher who translated this text, the way he shared with us is that this view always comes around because it's the origin view, it's the mother view that holds all spiritual traditions, and they always come back around to integrate that aspect. And when they do, humanity becomes more cooperative. Humanity treats the earth and all aspects of earth as its own body, and we see a resurgence of what we might call sustainability nowadays. We see that there's a collective value for that aspect expressed in all aspects of life. So we're seeing that occurring now. And we think it's important to be able to at least have a name for it so we can point to it. And currently, animism, or the idea that everything is sacred, is one of the ways to speak about this idea. Someone else, and if I pronounce, am I pronouncing right? Ziran. Okay. Someone else, how does it land on you? Someone who knows that word from your primary linguistic upbringing, how does it land on you? What does it mean? What kind of images does it bring up?
It also means let it be, let it happen.
Let it happen, let it be.
Naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is one of the central principles in the Tao Te Ching, and one of the central principles in the practice of Chan Zen, as we read in the Xi Jinping. Janelle, do you want to pick up from there?
Well, when you were discussing this sort of worldview and sense of reality, in China, you wonder why, when Buddhism came, well, why do they need it? You know, mm-hmm. It seems like everything is taken care of. But I think probably the reason Buddhism was as well received as it was is because it was a response to suffering in the world, and everyone suffers more or less a great deal. And Buddhism is sort of rooted in that difficulty and trying to respond to it in ways that can be especially helpful. Of course, Buddhism came from India, and so there was a lot of mental investigation and struggle with the problem of suffering. And so I think the in some ways the Buddhist message was primarily involved with thought and with the way the mind can or should respond to suffering or to life as it unfolds. But the actual involvement with the physical body became, that was not so interesting and not so important. The stress was on the mind and how to deal with things and the mind. And then also when Buddhism came, it was brought by monks, by all men who brought this teaching. So the feminine possibilities in Buddhism were certainly not primary matter. So Buddhism came into China, which also is a patriarchal culture. So I think it was that aspect made it acceptable to some people. But of course, one of the big problems is that the traditional monks from India, they a monk, to become a real monk, you have to abandon your family. Well, that's not going to be very popular in China, because it's a Confucian culture, and the family is really essential. So that always became a problem in China, is the sort of conflict between abandoning the family and retaining connections with the family. Also, the monks traditionally didn't work for their food and so on and so forth. They lived by donations, and that was their practice, was to walk about each day and receive donations from people, and that was also considered, that was one way to give people an opportunity to give. So you're, it's a kind of amusing situation, but you, by your need, offering your need to somebody, that person, you're enabling that person to respond with generosity to you. And generosity, of course, is a wonderful virtue and an important practice. So the monks, by living so frugally and living with need, and they are enabling the populace to practice generosity. But again, in China, that's not very, just doesn't feel right, as far as the way that life connects with reality. You're responsible for your own welfare and so on. So it was established by certain Chan teachers that a day without work was a day without food. So if you're going to be a good Chan monk, you have to work and support the temple in that way. So those were big differences, which when Buddha got to China, that changed a lot. But in China also, the monks never married. They always remained celibate. By the time Chang got to Japan and becoming Zen, it also was, monks were also supposed to be rather celibate, but eventually in Japan, the Pure Land sect, members of the Pure Land sect, began to marry, because they felt they were ordinary people then. They're not that special. And then eventually, even in Zen, there were some marriage became part of the practice, or part of the basic situation. And so even today in Japan, temples tend to be kind of a family-oriented place. And then the first son of the family becomes the priest, he will be the priest for the next generation. So they have a built-in system of transmission by having a family. So through all of these changes, Buddhism is certainly a very flexible religion according to the location in which it finds itself. And it's certainly changing in this country as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's this teaching that I've encountered in India, China, Tibet, Nepal, that essentially there and stories that seem that they come from there, is the way that I've received the stories. And the story is essentially that a person from the village. It's usually portrayed as kind of a simple person that has family responsibility, and their main life is around the house and around cultivating the land, comes to the temple or comes to the Taoist yogi or the monk, and they basically say, I've received some teachings. I understand the basic principle of practice, and I understand that stillness meditation is essential for the cultivation of the path. But I don't have any time because I have kids and I have a farm. And you know, often it's that, you know, the husband passed away or the wife passed away, and there's a lot of sort of social familial responsibility. And the yogi or the monk essentially says, here's the teaching for you. And this teaching is completely equal in its potency to the monks who live full-time and practice in the temple. So have full confidence that this is the full transmission from the ancestral lineage of the most direct path to realizing what it is to realize within Taoism or Buddhism. Treat every being and thing as Buddha, without exception, and arrange your conduct in that way. And of course, in every story, the person sort of goes through a process of not really believing that it's that direct. And the yogi or the monk essentially convincing them that in that contact point of the relationship, if you treat the door handle and the, you know, and the pot you're cooking dinner as literally as the body of the Buddha or the deity, then your practice will bear fruition in this lifetime. And I haven't been to Korea, but there's a famous story of the Korean monk Venerable Songchon from there who gave this teaching also to monks who were struggling, that he said, there is no inanimate object. Every single thing, being, thing is Buddha. Behave accordingly. And I just thought this was such a pith teaching, such a direct teaching, and it harkens back to animism and then integrates a kind of Taoist vision and then brings us into connection with maybe one of the strongest points of Buddhism coming from India, and that's mind training. And so the image that kind of emerges here is like a weave, and each of the three strands has a strength and brings something. And so in all of those places, I constantly hear the story that Buddhists need Taoist and Taoist need Buddhist, and they both need animists. The animist reminds us of the natural world. If we get too locked into the Zendo and we kind of forget the forest and the Buddha of moss and boulders, the animist reminds us of that part. And if we just get into mind focus, looking at causal links, and we forget the body, the Taoist says, how does your little toe feel? Is your liver connected to spring? Is your heart connected to summer? Is your kidneys connected to winter? Is your spleen connected to, you know, the transitional periods? And bring us back to the sacredness of the body. And in this way, these three have strengthened and supported each other throughout, you know, the development of Chan Zen. And there's some great stories, some great writings. If you look up stories of Hakuin and his return back to some Taoist principles and body-based practices, there are these beautiful stories of kind of returning to the body, sometimes because of the need to heal a health condition or an injury that, you know, monks incurred just like all of us. And they often went back to the roots of body-based practices to help their body-mind heal and integrate their sitting practice. So in this way, we felt that it's appropriate to kind of this sense that like the motherly quality that exists holding all of these practices, even though the cultures were patriarchal, sort of roots of the whole practice to us feels very feminine, very maternal, very caring in a kind of way that we feel is really important for for all of us to remember as we move forward in our cultivation. And perhaps now more than ever, to really make to not to between cushion and everyday life, between zendo and office, right? That we're expressing those virtues of relatedness and treating all beings, things as one tradition calls motherly Buddha, as motherly Buddha, as mother of us all, that somehow the Dharma becomes more relevant on more levels of our human life in this moment of shared human history, where we are right now, right? Yeah. So we'd also like to open up to reflection, questions, comments, how that lands in your experience.
Question. I've been, you know, more like studying and practice like with everybody else, I think, and my practice is more based on Buddhism and yoga. And I've been more like a yoga practitioner than a Buddhist practitioner, but yet, you know, I recognize, you know. So, but what I've been noticing about the last few years more so, even the land of medicine, we've been here, and it's a learning, is that it came from India. It went out to the Asian countries, and to me, it's saying that it's all the same. There's one tree. You know, each tree has a branch. Each branch is a religion or a culture. Yet they're one energy. Like Koban says, samsara and nirvana are the same. So to me, it's saying there's one energy that can express itself from that one form of energy and just multiply itself, you know, and here we are. And it's also, it seems like we're being taught, you know, how to not get along, what we do, and then how to come back and get back to getting along, you know, be it African-American, white, Chinese, Japanese, whatever our differences were, they can't take us to the next level unless we let go. So I think the Indian practice, the yoga practice, I'm just learning, the question is it all just the same with one energy expressing itself? And also could do many other things too, like, you know, just like what we're doing, to share itself in many different ways. I'm gonna get too deep. My question is, isn't, aren't we just all the same one energy that could just multiply itself and express itself by way of consciousness and let us know that we all are the same. There's nothing to be afraid of, you know, because with love you can conquer anything, but yet we have to practice it to know it. And it seems like there's like a lot of fog in between things, you know, that we're trying to understand and grasp and, you know, hold on to, you know, and relations to emptiness, you know, to the emptiness part. The question is, the Dalai Lama says, once you surrender everything, the mind knows exactly what to do. So my question is, how do we learn to surrender more so me can come more in the forefront into the light? And not the karma, the samskaras, you know. So what's the practice for that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to let go of,
mm-hmm,
and surrender, you know. So the other part of me can come back into the forefront, you know, like the Buddhist teachings or the Indian yogi teachers who came, you know, they came for a reason to teach us that we're all the same. But it seems like it's taking us a long time to recognize that we are all the same. And I think that's what this is about, to realize, hey, wow, whatever that Chinese word was that you used, and then they said it reminded her of nature. It's like, wow, right? It's like, wow,
mm-hmm,
you know, we're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm just saying. It just seems like the teachings came from India to let us know that we're all the same.
Yeah, maybe it's one of the greatest gifts of that, if we track it back to India, where the convergence of the yogic traditions, right? So the emergence of the historical Buddha happening within the time where yoga was everywhere within spiritual culture. So we can kind of go back to that moment and look through that lens. So yoga's citta vritti nirodha. The whole process of yoga is defined simply as the mind that was seeing to no longer sees to, it sees not to. And then the second sutra, yoga is citta vritti nirodha, pada drashtuhu swarupe vastanam. When the mind that was seeing to no longer sees to, then intrinsic nature abides as itself. So it's the same teaching as the Xinqing Ning, the same teaching as, you know, Wu Wei Dao or Ziran. So yeah, the fluctuating consciousness seeing to, you could say seeing to samsara arises, not seeing to nirvana arises, and they're not two.
One.
Yeah.
See, I think it's like we get to do both. We get to go into samsara and feel suffering and go into understanding, feel it, and we grow off of it and say, oh wow, I don't need to do that anymore. But it seems like we have such a long time period to be able to figure that out, you know, that we, you know, it's like, I'm gonna shut up after this, but I just want to say, it seems like all religions are the same. They all say the same thing. Thou shalt not kill, love your neighbor, love yourself. It's just in a different language, a different expression, it seems like, you know? But like, for me, it's just one tree with many branches. I'm trying to get to know that tree's roots, the energy that comes through. That's the emptiness I'm looking for, is to go, okay, let me move this ego out the way, craving out the way. And like, come here, let me talk to you for a minute. You know, so it's like getting past that, you know, but, you know, to realize, I think, you know, but I don't want to talk too much. But I'm just saying, I mean, it's just real. I think we make it too much out of things that we need to learn from. But after a while, it's like, yeah, I really have to go through that. I already know you.
Yeah. This is what Jiro was talking earlier about, how the Taoists brought a kind of playful quality to this.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding circular time. So one of the great practices for that is following those seasonal patterns and kind of going like, oh, what you said, ouch, that hurt. Oh, when I don't do that, it doesn't hurt. Oh, heyam dukam anagatam was the teaching from India.
Mm.
Future suffering is avoidable.
That's a good one.
Right. Oh, that's that kind of insight that connects us to the causal chain, right? If I drop this rock on my toe, it will hurt. If I cease to make that choice, then that particular quality of pain won't exist anymore. So tracking that back to not to was this ending suffering, right? No longer caught in the samskaric cyclical pattern. And they all shared that understanding, all three of these traditions. Animism was like stay in relationship with what is. Taoism was cultivate that flowing with what is, and Buddhism was see the truth of the nature of things very clearly and relate in that way. So yeah.
I just wanted to share that part of my Taoist training. Most of my Taoist training was all this sort of image of returning to your true nature, that all the different practices sent you into the direction of return. And the idea that the sense of that, we all have the experience of, we're all loaded up with influences and conditions. And then we end up spending so much of our life forgetting what our true nature is, because we're living in relationship to all the conditions and influences of our life. But I think, like, so much of the practice that I learned, and it took a long time to sort of travel back, because mostly we think we're going to find something out here. But that really the discovery is in the return. And I think a lot of what you were sharing and talking about, the truth that resides in us, the truth that resides in nature, the truth that's available to us all the time, we lose sight of it because of our conditioning. So when we can, the, you know, I'm sure, I don't know what everybody's practices are in this room, but the, you know, to just take that moment to return, you know, and then it's a process that, you know, moves in different directions because we sit in this room together and we fall under a certain influence. The other thing I wanted to say was a teacher of mine years ago used to say that if you took the mystics of all the different practices, everybody has different training. But if you came into the room together and there was a ritual that needed to happen, everybody would know exactly what to do. So I think that image, how we can meet each other, how we can see each other and greet each other, when we can free ourselves from the unnecessary and see each other in the moment, see the truth of the moment, which is not easy to find, what we're all spending lifetimes doing, that then I just see you and you see me and we all are here together in this moment. And we're not separate from the trees outside or this floor or the sky above us.
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, to know that you can separate yourself and come back to yourself. See, what I'm saying is pay attention to yourself, what you're going through, because this to me is about, we call it self-realization, becoming sure. Self-realized, you know? And so it's like, we get to not look at it, and all of a sudden something bad could happen to wake me up, or something good to wake me up. We get to experience, you know, suffering, and then we get the experience, like you say, the return. Mm-hmm. You know, you go and learn something, and you come back into yourself, you know? Okay.
I think we have another question back here.
As a compliment to Jyoti's question, I'm just curious about when we realize we have this realization that all things are kind of interconnected and interlaced. I think the metaphor that Kai and you used of the thread, how it's all part of one thing, even though one point might recognize itself as individual. When we have that realization as individuals or as a small group, how then do we go and carry that into society and into a culture that is so individualistic and very selfish to the point where, you know, we're all driving these cars that weigh a ton each, and we're all single, me in my car alone, and it's that, and then there's greed and just that extended to the nth degree. So how do we carry this into that without feeling so much friction? So when I go back into the world, I just feel this immense friction, no matter how much equanimity I try to exist with. It just feels like there's a lot of tension. Like I'm a point in the thread, and these other individualistic points are like stretching because they want to go in their own direction. They think they're me and special and separate from the plane of all existence.
Yeah, thank you for that personal share. It's, I can certainly relate, and I imagine many of us can relate after a retreat or after being in space of Sangha. And I just want to acknowledge the heart, the real heart of that. I asked the same question sitting in that position on retreat in Nepal after a really deep retreat in the seven points of mind training in the Vajrayana tradition, and pointing out instruction and kind of realizing that it is actually unequivocally true, the non-separation. But in a couple of days, I'm going to fly on an airplane from Kathmandu back to LA and get on the 405 freeway, and I'm a little concerned I'm going to lose contact with this. And my teacher basically said, that's why the three threads weave together, and you can, in whichever tradition, but this is, you know, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha within that view. And so he said, I never stop studying. I never stop having conversation with my guru. I'm in conversation with the whole lineage, and I'm reliant on the Sangha. Because though the level of distortion in the world is so strong, and it's sort of the best, most challenging thing, right? Neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. Right? It's fabulous. It doesn't matter, you have 40 years of conditioning. Do 40 days of sitting and Qigong movement, and you can transform 40 years of conditioning. Why? Because it's not stuck. The whole thing's malleable, it's convertible. So that's fantastic. All of our pains, our traumas, our conditioning, they're all, because everything's changing, it's all workable. And you can have recognition of inherent wholeness, fully go fully into it, and then be conditioned back into separation. The whole thing's malleable, right? And so this is wonderful because to me, what's wonderful about it is it made me realize that the actual security of practice is in the relatedness, right? Even the highest lamas I met, the highest yogis I met, they still talk to their teachers. They still talk to Guru Rinpoche. They still talk to Shakyamuni. They're still constantly, and going to that place that's like child speaking to parent, to that place with this heart that you just shared, it's making me emotional. Because I'm remembering one of my teachers in India said, when you ask a question like that and you look for support, if you stay in the level of like, I'll still do it all myself, you stay in pride level, the support doesn't come. This is like a big yogi, a very powerful big yogi, and said, it's only when I came to the place of being like a child and I expressed that concern that the support actually came. And that was after years of meditating alone in caves in the Himalayas. Kind of forcing with ego, you know. He had a lot of prana and a lot of practices, but internally, privately, he was struggling, feeling not supported. And the Sangha thought he was, you know, didn't need that, but he hit that place, that humanness. As a human being, we are relational. It doesn't matter if you realize inherent Buddhahood, you still have this relational human quality that it's a child part and it needs to feel support. So that's why we talk about the ancestors. So we have the confidence. That's why we have Sangha, right? And we need it. We need each other. And the Taoist, what the Taoist call this is the body of Tao. And it means the community is literally one body. If you're hungry and struggling and there's delusion happening, somehow it's happening in my body. So we reflect to each other that, and we practice in such a way that we rise together. And then the weave is shimmering in that way. But it's our responsibility to uphold that through our action, through our conduct. That's what practice means, right? So yeah, and in the most human way, you know, if you go back to Boulder or whatnot, and like whenever we're wavering, we call each other, we connect, like, hey, can we talk through something? Hey, and when we do that, the human functionality of Sangha really serves its purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.